Hello, and welcome back to the Baseball Trade Values Podcast. My name is Joshua Iverson, and I am the associate editor of BaseballTradeValues.com, joined, as always, by founder and owner John Bitzer. John, we are well into spring training. We're actually just chatting, and before the next podcast episode comes back, there's going to be real big league games that count with that Korea series. So we are right in the thick of it. The season's right around the corner. How are you doing? How are you enjoying this this spring training period here?
I'm starting to feel optimistic. You know, plans for youth baseball are kicking in. I got three boys. I got two baseball players on five different teams. We do club. We do travel. We do rec. We do it all. So it's a really busy time here. And then the Major League Baseball season's kicking in, and I couldn't be happier.
Yeah, likewise. So far I've made it out to one spring game out here in Arizona. It was A's Rangers, and it was good to see some familiar faces out there, you know, the Evan Carters and Marcus Semiens of the world, and a Brent Rooker, and, you know, it's obviously spring, it doesn't really matter, and the A's are the A's anyway, but just a fun time at the ballpark. The weather's great out here this month, I'm enjoying it while I can, but I'm ready for this season to start. I'm ready to go catch a few D-backs games. I heard they were pretty good last year.
Yeah, they were, but you know what's weird is, like, did the offseason end? We still got guys out there that haven't signed and some questions, and we'll get into it, I'm sure. But it feels like it just sort of, like, did it end? Is it over? I don't know. Are there moves still to be made? Let's get into it.
Yeah, and it's kind of bucked what I expected. And I think I might have said this on the last podcast where, you know, I didn't expect these pitchers to have as much trouble finding a team. And it's not only the, you know, the Snell and Montgomery of it all, right? Those two are obviously looking for pretty hefty contracts, deserve pretty hefty contracts, and so it's kind of a stalemate of getting them what they deserve. But, like, is it the two of them that are holding up the markets for Michael Lorenzen and Mike Clevinger? Like, arms are starting to drop on some of these contending teams. They're starting to lose guys to injuries. How have those guys not been scooped up yet? Like, that seems like a no-brainer unless you're really just, you know, trying to play the waiting game with the two big guys.
And I just saw a report that Jordan Montgomery is still holding out for a seven-year deal. I mean, come on. At this point, just grab a team, man. I don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's very defensible for him especially to not be looking toward the, you know, Chapman, Bellinger, opt-out short contract route. Like, that doesn't seem to make as much sense for him. You kind of know what you're getting with him. You're getting a steady Eddie mid rotation, and, like, he loses a tick and okay, he's a back end guy, but he's fine. He's going to eat innings for you. Like, I feel like you're pretty confident in that. He's not the kind of guy where he needs to prove something in 2024 to get that big contract. So I understand it from that standpoint of, like, just basically putting that message out there. I'm not going to be settling for this kind of deal, but seven, like, like, at this point, like,
yeah.
What I would take the nicest 5 or 6 year deal I can and start suiting up and get ready to join a team and pitch in the regular season, because that's coming up soon. Whenever these guys sign, I don't think they're going to be ready for opening day. So, you know, from that standpoint, the field value that you're getting on this deal is decreasing by the week. You know, you lose a start of them every week that they go unsigned.
Totally. So my question still stands. Is the offseason over? I'm not sure, but we got to get on with it. The season's, you know, about to start, and I just wanted to let everybody know. So we'll have some articles coming up soon on, you know, as we usually do at each, twice a year, the end of the off season. And then after the deadline, we kind of, compile, Josh does a trade recap of all the trades that happen. I do sort of an analysis piece on, like, okay, how did our model do? And, so hopefully those are actually not, I know those are coming soon, but this year, because we started, we also got into free agent and extension modeling. We're going to show how those did as well, which will be super exciting. We've got a few extensions already, probably more to come, but we've got enough free agents to talk about as well. So we'll recap the trade season, we'll recap the free agency, and we'll recap the extensions in the next 2 weeks or so.
Yeah, and I'm really excited to see the results of that free agent extension, you know, performance this off season. You know, living through it day by day, you remember, okay, that one was, like, right on the money, that one was way off what happened there. Like, a few of those cases stand out in my mind, but, like,
yep,
you know, I couldn't give you a solid guess as to what our hit rate was there, so I'm excited to see that one.
I think you'd be pleasantly surprised. Yep.
Yeah. Well, cool. Let's get into it. I just mentioned his name a minute ago, so I suppose we need to lead with Matt Chapman, number two of the so-called Boris Four. He finds his home, and it's really the spot that made the most sense. He lands with the Giants. It's a three-year, $54 million guarantee with, you know, we really need to decide how we're phrasing these contracts. Is this a three-year deal with two opt-outs, or is it a one-year deal with two player options? Like, somebody needs to make a decision so we can just stick to it here. I'm kind of, it feels like it's reported differently each time it happens, but
totally.
I digress. It's a all intents and purposes, it's a three-year $54 million guarantee. That's the baseline of what he can earn if he wants it, which we have as a pretty good deal for the Giants. We have Chapman at $69.3 million in field value over those 3 years. And, you know, you can factor in the draft pick that the Giants are giving up for them. And, you know, Chapman has some more leverage in this deal and it's front loaded. So, you know, if he does opt out, I mean, there's still surplus on that first year at $20 million. So it's not fully like super heavily front loaded, but there is some leverage there. And so you can factor those things in and say that it's maybe a little bit closer than that, you know, 15 million ish gap. But I think no matter how you slice it, everyone's pretty much in agreement that, yeah, this is a really good fit and a really good deal for the Giants because, you know, we've talked a lot about how they continue to miss out on these superstar players. And it seems like this offseason they've kind of pivoted to the second and third tiers instead. And they have really improved their team. And this was a spot where it made a lot of sense to continue down that road of getting a lockdown third base defender. You know, no offense to JD Davis, who we will talk about in a little bit here, but Chapman is a significantly better defender. And when your ace is a guy like Logan Webb, who's not a pure pitch to contact type, but contact is a part of his game, you want everything that's hit to that left side of the infield to be scooped up and turn into an out. And Chapman's going to make that happen. So really clean fit there. I mean, obviously there's the ballpark fit of this is a guy whose bat has been a little bit of a question, especially in 2023, and he's going to a park that isn't the most favorable for that. But this is also a guy we saw succeed as a hitter in the Oakland Coliseum. So it's not like he doesn't have it in him. And, you know, on the offensive profile, there's some pros and cons that people have kind of gone back and forth of where, you know, he hits the ball really hard, but maybe he's not catching up to fastballs like he used to. And is that, you know, an injury? Is that just a timing thing? Is that aging? Like, what are we looking at here? And so there's enough question marks here that kind of led Chapman down this path of sitting on the market for so long and accepting a deal like this. But of all the places he could have landed and all the kind of deals he could have gotten, I don't think he did too poorly here. I think it's, like I said, just a clean fit and reunites him with Bob Melvin and with some other A's folks that he knows. And so, yeah, there's not a whole lot to dislike about this for the Giants side and for maybe like a personal side for Matt Chapman going back to the Bay. It's all about just, you know, the financials and Boris and whether money was left on the table because of how things were handled this offseason by his camp.
Yeah, and it looks like it was just based on our modeling. So we had 1 year fair value for him at $26.7 million. So that first year he's making 20. So that suggests he might actually opt out. Now, obviously, that's just based on numbers and projections. We'll see how it really turns out because maybe he likes it there and maybe he'll, you know, continue on, in which case he gets more guaranteed money. But just going by the numbers, you know, there's a little bit of surplus value in that. So the only thing from the Giants' point of view that is guaranteed is that first year at 20. So if he does better than that, which on paper it looks like he might, then he might opt out. So it might be only a one-year deal, but he might like it enough there that to your point about, you know, the old friends in the Bay Area, and, you know, I think, you know, maybe there's, you know, optimism for him staying on beyond 1 year. So anyway, it's, you know, clearly he didn't get as much as he wanted. He, you know, he waited and waited. He turned down a reported extension from the A's a couple of years ago. Probably wasn't a big amount of money, but we'll see. But of course, Boris is his agent, and so Boris said, "Okay, don't take an extension. Let's see how you do." And so he kind of, I kind of feel bad a little bit from that standpoint because Matt was like, "Okay, my big payday is coming. I'm gonna wait for it," and then it didn't really come. And this is sort of like a, I guess I'll take it kind of deal. So, you know, but at the other side of it, you know, he kind of had a down year. He kind of slumped for a while with the bat. still got the glove, but he's not getting any younger. He's 31, so these days 31-year-olds who are kind of in decline don't get big deals. So the reality is it was just kind of unfortunate timing.
Yeah, and I wonder if he was negatively impacted by kind of the shape of his 2023 season, where he was looking like an MVP candidate in April, and then, like you said, he really tailed off with the bat after that and just kind of slumped the rest of the year for the most part, outside of a few stretches here and there. And so I know in 2024 here, you know, two decades post Moneyball, like, teams aren't going to be placing too much stock into that kind of thing, you know, the shape of the season and when somebody gets hot. You know, teams aren't saying, oh, this guy was good in the second half, so that's just the guy he is going forward. Like, that's, there's some of that out there, and some of that that gets taken into account, but that's not like the baseline of analysis. Like, we've moved well past that, but I still do wonder, like, you know, if he had struggled for the first 4 months of the season and really turned it on for the last 2 months, I wonder if teams would have felt more comfortable going, okay, here's a fifth year, or whatever the sticking point was.
Yeah, and yeah. Look at what Teoscar got. It was sort of the opposite way. I think I'll double check, but I think he slumped in the beginning and then got hot in the end.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so he got more money. So I think there's a little bit of recency bias to your point.
Yeah. As far as the rest of, you know, the Giants and where this kind of leaves them, he's, again, like I said, he's in this, like, second tier. He's a very good player, does a lot of things well, but he's not quite at this Ohtani, Judge, Correa, and Harper level that they've been swinging and missing for a while on that end of the free agent pool. But I do like that at least this offseason, they didn't just say, well, we missed out on Correa, so let's just run into the year with all of our platoons and see what happens. Like, they were active, they were willing to spend money, and they were willing to improve their team even if they weren't getting their top guys. And I'm interested, and I think a lot of people are interested, to see if that translates to the Blake Snell or Jordan Montgomery market here. It seems like Snell is a name that's been connected a little more often, and I think that makes sense, especially because he is, of those two guys, more likely to take the shorter Chapman-Bellinger-type deal. And it seems like the Giants are really hesitant to hand out these 5, 6, 7 year free agent deals. And so they might prefer something a little cheaper on that end and, you know, puts them over the luxury tax in 1 year. But that's, I believe it would be their first year going over. And so they can maybe afford the penalties this first time around. And so he seemed like a bit of a cleaner fit there, but especially as their rotation has been just continuing to drop like flies throughout spring training, they've had multiple injuries there. And it already wasn't the deepest rotation in the league to begin with. So there's some wrinkles there. You know, Alex Cobb might come back sooner than expected, and Robbie Ray will be back at some point this season. And, you know, they do have a crop of young arms that are at least kind of interesting that they might want to try out. But I think if they decide that they're going to do it, you know, regardless of what their public messaging has been, there's certainly room in the tank for another big move with one of those two pitchers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's something going on there. They're being very cagey, I think. I'm guessing, just total guessing, that they've got some talks with, you know, one of those pitchers. And it could be just, you know, Lorenzen or Warmbody or Clevinger. But yeah, they're going to need somebody. The other thing, just to wrap up on Chapman, that I'm starting to sort of wonder, and I don't put a lot of stock into it, but keep in mind, with all of the sort of messiness of the A's leaving Oakland, and suddenly the Giants have Bob Melvin, and now they have Matt Chapman, and like our former A's fans, or okay, current A's fans who don't like supporting John Fisher, going to say, maybe go see Matt Chapman over on the other side of the bay. I don't think that's a big thing, but I'm just interestingly keeping my eye on it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways to read into that, right? Of and going beyond even just the Chapman and Melvin of it all, but just kind of the situation the Giants find themselves in if this move actually does happen, where, you know, the one perspective is, wow, you know, they're going to have the Bay Area all to themselves. They're going to scoop up a lot of these more casual fans. I'm not trying to suggest that, you know, an A's lifer is ever going to switch over to the Giants, like a lot of folks in the media have kind of suggested there. As A's fans, you and I both know that that's not the most realistic, just right. Knowing that fan base and kind of the the vitriol that they've had at times for the Giants and for how the Giants have treated, you know, the fan base and the team. But there's probably some more casual folks in that mix who would not necessarily change allegiances, but say, oh, there's only one show in town now. I guess I'm going to a Giants game tonight. And so that could have a positive impact on attendance. And you could view that as, well, positive impact on attendance, that just means more money and more eyeballs. And, you know, maybe this team makes more money and is more aggressive in free agency and becomes a real powerhouse here. The alternative is they're not going to have to do a lot to earn that money and those eyeballs because there's no other show in town. Yeah. So
right.
Maybe it lets them kind of sit on their laurels a little bit and just let the world pass them and kind of hang out with this middling 500-ish roster like they have the last few years.
I have a 13-year-old with a Matt Chapman A's jersey, and his best position is third base when he plays. So, like, he woke me up in the middle of the night, like, Chapman, to the Giants! And I'm like, okay. And then I went back to sleep. But then I'm like, but then I thought about the next day, I'm like, oh, I guess he cares about that. And is that going to matter? You know, so I'm wondering about the kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And just being blunt about it, the Giants are an easier sell for kids than the A's are. They gotta yeah. slide. Have you seen the slide in their ballpark?
I know.
Yeah. Okay, well, actually, before we move on for the Giants, the last kind of piece of it here is J.D. Davis. I mentioned him earlier. The Giants placed him on waivers just yesterday, actually. And, you know, there had been talk throughout the week of, like, where does this move leave Davis? He, since coming over from the Mets, he improved pretty substantially defensively at third base. You know, not to the point of he's anywhere near Matt Chapman's level, but, like, you can put him there and not have to shield your eyes on every single play, it seems like. So that was, he was going to be a big part of the team's third base plans, if not just the full-on starter there at the position in 2024. And so now he's displaced. And this is a roster with a lot of these other kind of role player-ish guys who aren't going anywhere. Like, Wilmer Flores, I guess, is the other one you would look at, but he's been kind of lauded as this clubhouse presence, and, you know, he plays a few different positions, not the best, but he plays them, and he hits lefties really well, and so he brings a lot to the table where he's an important part of their roster construction, and that just leaves Davis as more of the odd man out here. Like, they just, with what they need as far as backups and as far as some of these guys, these young players and guys out of options and things like that, there's not room for him on this roster. And so he's placed on waivers. There's still an opportunity for a trade here. And the interesting wrinkle to all of this, which I'm unsure if we'll see, because I would assume a trade comes across here. He does have some surplus value. I believe it's like 4.4, if I pull this up.
Right.
Yes, he's at 4.4. But the wrinkle here is because Davis and the Giants went to arbitration, so not just because he was arbitration eligible and they agreed to a deal, but because they went to an actual hearing and the arbitrator had to decide his salary, that salary is not fully guaranteed until he makes the opening day roster. In the meantime, if he were, you know, if he somehow went unclaimed on waivers, again, very unlikely, the team could elect to just cut him. And rather than paying his full $6.9 million salary, it would be the first 30 days of pay, like 30-day termination fee, basically. So something a little bit over $1 million. So it would save them close to $6 million there if they were to just cut him entirely, if they couldn't come up with a trade or a waiver claim or whatever. Seems a lot more likely, especially because of some of the, like, you know, grievance possibilities that opens up. Seems a lot more likely that he just gets traded somewhere. There's a lot of teams that could use a bat like his. You know, he's no super duper star by any means, but he's an above average bat, and if he can fake it at third base, that's got use on a lot of rosters. Plus, you know, play some first base, DH, wherever. So
yeah, it's unfortunate timing because the market has just cratered for infielders. You saw Ahmed Rosario take a $1.5 million deal. Saw Gio Urshela take a $1.5 million deal. Both of those on paper were worth more. So it's possible that JD Davis has no place and no market. And I'm sure they were trying to trade him in the last week or so. And, you know, by making this declaration that he's going on waivers, it may be an indication that they can't get a deal done, in which case they may have to go to that, you know, cut him and save some money scenario. just because the market is totally tanked. Pitt budgets are largely set. You know, that's another reason why the free agent market isn't really moving anymore either, because their teams are basically saying, I'm at my budget. I can't afford them. So, yeah, it's really just a, you know, bad timing thing. And you can question whether, you know, the moves that Farhan Zaidi made is, like, the smartest from a value point of view, because you're sort of like, you know, you're basically eating some value here at JD Davis. On the other hand, they got Chapman, as I said earlier, for an undervalued sort of amount of money. So I guess it all nets out in the wash, but it's still kind of like, yeah, you could have done that a little smoother.
Yeah, yeah. In my opinion, this is a move that the A's absolutely should make. You know, they're early in the waiver order because they're so bad. So they would have an opportunity here, and currently their starting third baseman is Abraham Toro, which was a weird move at the time, and his competition there is a young prospect, Darrell Hernaez, who they picked up in the Cole Irvin trade, and like he's got some helium. He's looked good since joining their system, but it would be really rushing him to the big leagues, and why? What's the point of that, given where they are in the competitive cycle and all that? So, you know, picking up basically free trade bait here, as well as just like another warm body at a position, like seems like a no-brainer to them, but they're also the A's. And, you know, even despite their, you know, $20 in payroll commitments for 2024, they're not going to be excited to take on that contract. So would make sense to me on the surface, but there's a lot of teams that would make sense on the surface. You know, you look at the Angels have been kind of trying to add some offense. Don't have a whole lot on the corners right now, guaranteed. Hey, no,
look, Rendon has a groin strain. Go figure.
Yep. Yep. We're all shocked. Cleveland always needs power. You know, there's plenty of teams here that could use a guy like Davis. And so I would be surprised if he passed through and got cut or something and they couldn't trade him. But also, to your point, you know, he's been on the block for a week since the Chapman signing. And so the fact that they haven't gotten anything done and went to the point of placing him on waivers kind of tells you where the market might be on him, which is,
that's right.
You know, I think it's a chance for some team to take advantage and add like a 2-ish win player to their roster for basically just the cost of the contract.
Yeah.
All right. I suppose, you know, let's just knock all the Giants stuff out of the way early and talk very quickly about the Cardinals signing Brandon Crawford. It's a one-year, $2 million guarantee, and it certainly came with some blowback from kind of both angles here, where, you know, longtime Giant and wanted to come back to the Giants. The Giants don't have anything going on at shortstop right now. Like, it's a spring training battle between Nick Ahmed and Marco Luciano, and it's really who wants it less, right? Like, it's not pretty. Luciano, top prospect, but really has some contact issues to sort out at the AAA level. He's only played 18 games there and struck out 36% of the time. That's just not gonna stick. And that's in addition to some defensive questions that some evaluators have for him. So even if he's potentially the future at shortstop, I don't know if that future is opening day 2024. And then I think we know what Nick Ahmed is at this point, and after that, you're talking about, you know, is Tyro Estrada sliding over from second to short? Are you spotting Wilmer Flores at shortstop at age 33? Like, it's not a pretty situation there. And so, on paper, it seems like a great spot, especially for Crawford having been reportedly willing to play kind of this utility role and move to second and third when he needs to and play a bench role. But they needed to, he was holding out for a big league deal. They only wanted to offer him a minor league contract. And I was actually just listening to Grant Brisby of The Athletic, long time covering the Giants and long time, you know, good writer who knows his stuff when it comes to San Francisco. He was talking on the Effectively Wild podcast and basically explained it like, you know, they couldn't, you know, it's not as flexible. If you bring Crawford back, you know, not only are you clearing out the 40-man spot to sign him to a guaranteed big league deal, whereas for a guy like Ahmed, you could get him on the minor league deal and make the decision based on how camp goes. You know, with Crawford, you're just saying you have a spot on the roster, and that kind of, there's no competition then at shortstop. He's just kind of your guy. So not only that, but it also just makes things uglier. You know, if you get 2 months into the season and Ahmed isn't hitting, you just cut him and try someone else, and it's not really a big deal. If you get 2 months into the season and Crawford isn't hitting and you send him away, that, you know, causes some ripples for the fan base and, you know, for such a San Francisco icon at this point, like, that's just not how you want to treat the guy. So understandable from that perspective. It's kind of just a unfortunate situation on both sides that, like, on the surface looks like it made all the sense in the world, but when you dig into it, maybe had a few impediments there. And instead he'll be some shortstop depth for the Cardinals, who were dealing with some injuries of their own at the position. And, you know, he's kind of in the Nick Ahmed role over there, where if they have to cut him, who cares? He's just Brandon Crawford. He's got no ties to the Cardinals, really. He's just kind of a hired gun, I guess you could put it. So maybe a little bit easier on the optics over there.
Yeah, those are all good points. I mean, it's clear that, you know, Crawford is close to retirement. I'm not sure what's left in the tank. Doesn't look like there's much left in the tank, but you can say the same thing about Ahmed. So you're just talking about two past the prime shortstops. Pick one. And the Giants pick the one with more flexibility.
Yeah, that's really all there is to it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's shift over to the Twins acquiring outfielder Manuel Margot. So there was a lot of updates to this deal as it was coming down the wire. And so apologies if I mischaracterize anything here, but I'll try to get this one right. So the deal ends up being Manuel Margot at, all right, we're already starting at a wrinkle. So at the time of this trade, we had Margot in the system at $2 million in surplus value. We had his salary entered just slightly incorrectly, so he actually should have been at $1.5 million in surplus. So Margot at $1.5 million, as well as infield prospect Rain Doncon at $4.2 million, as well as cash, which is going to be $4 million on top of the $4 million that already came to the Dodgers with Margot in the original trade from the Rays. So really paying down his contract. It ends up being just $4 million in 2024, and the Twins don't have to worry about his $2 million buyout on his 2025 team option. So it's basically just a straight 1 year, $4 million deal with the $12 million club option for 2025 if they decide to exercise that with no buyout on it. That's effectively what it becomes for the Twins. So total package is $1.5 million in Manuel Margot, $4.2 million in Rain Doncon, and $4 million in cash. That is headed to the Twins in exchange for infield prospect Noah Miller at $2.5 million. So looks very lopsided, very much like a major overpay by the Dodgers. You know, it's into that kind of territory that we've mentioned where the model might say it's accepted, but we're kind of looking at the parameters there, and maybe something that's in that kind of range should be considered rejected just with how sizable the gap is there. And it's a bit of a head scratcher as far as just what was given up here. So as far as the fit for the Twins, obvious sense, you know, they had Michael Taylor in the fold last year. They really need a second starting caliber center fielder to help accommodate for Byron Buxton's presumed injuries. So he's their guy there. I think Taylor is still holding out for a multi-year deal, and I don't think the Twins wanted to go there quite yet. So instead they get Margot, good fit for them. They managed to get an interesting prospect out of this in Doncon, where, you know, he's a big, flashy hit, power hitter type guy, and you know, questionable whether he makes enough contact, questionable whether he plays good enough defense to stay on the infield, but, like, there's some upside there for a young prospect. And they get Margot paid all the way down to $4 million, which is a good bargain for a player with his skill set. And all the Dodgers get back is that $4 million in roster relief, the roster spot, and or $4 million in salary relief, the roster spot, and Miller, who's really looking more like a glove only, like, unless they really see something in the bat there that they can pull out, he just looks like a utility guy at the big league level. So it looks like an overpay by the numbers. It looks like an overpay by kind of the feel of it and what you see happening there. But it was, once again, like, the Dodgers have made a handful of trades that came through as overpays this offseason, and they were almost all because of roster crunches. They decided at this point that they would rather have Enrique Hernandez on their roster in a utility role than Margot. And so this was kind of the cost of doing that. They needed to open up a spot for Hernandez. They signed him to a one-year, $4 million deal, and he can play all over the field for them, and they preferred that flexibility and that fit over Margot. And so in order to open up the roster spot and save a few bucks, this was the cost of it.
Yeah, I don't have much more to add to that. I think that's all well said. I do think they like Kike Hernandez. Kike Hernandez himself, in his press conference or interviews after the signing, had said that he was talking about, like, you know, projections and computer programs and stuff. And he's like, what? They don't take into account his injury. Basically, he said that he was playing injured all year, which is accounting for his down year. But when I dug into his splits, I realized he still hits lefties really well. And he can play infield and outfield. So it gives him a little bit more flexibility, gives him that platoon righty that they wanted. Margot obviously has that, but maybe they didn't like him as much because he's only an outfielder. And, he costs more. So it's just saving a roster spot, saving some money. Yes, they tend to do this. They tend to value, like, the roster spot and the flexibility. And they don't value the value as much. So it is what it is.
Yeah, and Don Kahn is the type of, and I have no idea if I'm saying that right, but he's a real, like, boomer bust type prospect where, you know, you can see the tools, you can see the upside, but he's never really shown the performance, and there's such obvious gaps in his profile that, like, he's not the type where he settles in as, like, a two-win guy. He's either going to be, like, this real impact player, or he's never going to make it to even AAA. Like, that's what his future looks like. And so if they've already come down on the side of that coin that, like, we just don't think this guy has a future, he hasn't developed the way we want him to, even though, you know, some more neutral prospect evaluators might say, oh, he's got this upside, let's value him at this level, at, you know, this 4.2 level. If the Dodgers are really just totally out on him, then it's really just kind of the cost of doing business here. And maybe they'd rather have a guy where they know what they're getting in Miller and, you know, is what they're getting exciting? Not necessarily. He's, like I said, he's really looking like a glove-only backup type. But maybe that's just a profile that they liked a little better, or maybe they see something else here, or maybe they see a player who can at least contribute in some nominal way and has a high likelihood of making a big league roster as a backup, and maybe they prefer that over this guy who they just see as more of a coin flip to even get there in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, all I can figure there is they like the defense. Obviously, that's his main thing. And remember, they traded for Miguel Vargas, who is an older version of that, not much bat, but plays a solid glove.
Rojas.
Solid short, yeah. Rojas. But yeah, the other thing is, you know, the Dodgers have turned around guys with swing changes. Chris Taylor, Max Muncy. Like, maybe there's something they see that can kind of play with on the bat. I don't know. Because there's never been any evidence that he has a bat before. But maybe, you know, stranger things have happened.
Yeah, you can never count it out when it's the Dodgers or the Rays or whoever picking up a guy like this.
Right.
I guess the last kind of element here, and I don't think this is something that they really saw coming when they made this deal, but it's kind of an added benefit of it, is Hernandez has some, you know, he can play the infield. And as I mentioned, they probably preferred that flexibility just on the face of it, as opposed to an outfield-only guy like Margot. But it's ending up being a pretty crucial addition for them, I think, because their middle infield picture is looking quite shaky. They just decided to shift up their infield. Gavin Lux was not looking good at shortstop in spring training, in his first year back from, was that ACL injury?
Yeah.
And he was bouncing throws to first base left and right and just did not look comfortable out there. And so they've hit the nuclear option and shifted Lux to second base and are going to have Mookie Betts, who was already, you know, transitioning to the infield full time for really the first time in his career. Now instead of second base, that's going to be shortstop. And no doubts that a superb athlete like Betts can figure out shortstop. Last year, he kind of moonlit over there for a handful of games and graded out as average-ish, according to the defensive metrics in that very small sample. And like, he's just such an incredible athlete. You know, he has so many tools. Nobody's really denying that he could be at least serviceable over there. You know, he might not win a gold glove, but he'll at least hold down the fort, people are expecting. But it is still a pretty wild move to be making at this stage in Bett's career and at this stage, you know, halfway through spring training. And it makes that Hernandez addition look just a little bit more important. It just gives them a little bit more depth up the middle between Hernandez, between Miguel Rojas, like you mentioned, between Chris Taylor, who's still on the roster. And that's going to be pretty important because the two of them are going to have their question marks up the middle, and then they have Max Muncy penciled in at third base, and he's got his own defensive question marks. And look at the depth chart, and Miguel Vargas, their young infield prospect, he's nominally a third baseman but has his own defensive questions. So, you know, this is a super team. The Dodgers are one of the best teams in baseball. They have so much talent. They added Ohtani and Yamamoto and Glasnow, but they are not without their flaws. That infield defense is looking like a legitimate concern. It might be among the worst in baseball. And, you know, guys like Yamamoto and Glasnow, they're going to miss plenty of bats and, you know, factor Bobby Miller into that equation. Like, they're going to get the strikeouts. It's not always going to be a huge issue if the defense behind them isn't the cleanest, but it is going to, they're going to feel that. You know, we saw that with guys like Aaron Nola and Zach Wheeler in Philadelphia when that defense looked really bad, where their ERAs were just significantly higher than their FIPs year after year, and it's because of this. It's because the defense behind them couldn't turn the balls in play into outs. And so this is certainly going to be something to watch in Los Angeles over the course of the season. And it leads to the question of, well, why are they playing this game? Why don't they just go out and get a guy? Willy Adames has been sitting there. Like, no matter how much the Brewers like them, you can make the Brewers an offer they wouldn't refuse and get Willy Adames and not have this question.
Yeah, we just talked about how the Dodgers often overpay in trades. All right, go ahead. If anything is screaming, you know, trade for Willie, this is the moment, right? I don't know if you can look. I love Mookie, but I'm not sure he's a shortstop for the whole year, right? And then what else you got? You're rotating in Rojas and Kike, and maybe, you know, what do you got? And, you know, I just watching their spring training game yesterday where he missed a backhand play, and then there was a play, and then he made a tried to turn two, but then Lux threw it in the dirt, even at from second. So like, this is gonna take some doing, you know.
You could hear the Benny Hill music in the background.
Yeah, totally. So you know, then you're wondering, well, maybe they trade Lux, but you got to figure his value is gonna go down a little bit. So yeah, they gotta straighten that out. And you know, overpay for Adames and just call it a day. That's my recommendation.
Yeah, and I mean, I see the approach here, and especially if, you know, the Brewers are holding tighter onto Adames than maybe you'd expect them to, I see the approach and the reasoning behind, like, let's wait it out and see if that price comes down a little bit, because I don't expect, you know, I like a lot of players on that Brewers roster, but I don't expect them to all hit the ground running on day one. So maybe, you know, a rough month or two into the season and they start to view themselves, you know, less and less as contenders. Maybe it makes that discussion a little bit easier. So I don't hate that approach. Like, I it's defensible, especially because those names that I just mentioned of Kike Hernandez and Chris Taylor and Miguel Rojas, like, there's enough offense in that lineup that if push comes to shove, you just stick Rojas at shortstop, put Betts back at second, and yeah, you're theoretically losing some offense there, but you just signed Shohei Ohtani. You just signed Teoscar Hernandez. There's
right.
You have Freddie Freeman. You have Mookie Betts. You have Will Smith. Like, there's more than enough firepower in there. And guess what? Yoshinobu Yamamoto is on the mound, and he's gonna go seven scoreless. So, like, they have an embarrassment of riches to the point where, like, even this glaring flaw, they could, you know, pull from. They could. I don't want to say rob Peter to pay Paul. That's not like the right analogy here, but they could shave a little off the top of one of their many, many strengths to address their one glaring weakness and still be the best team in baseball. So, like, this isn't, you know, sound the alarms, they're going to lose 100 games or anything like that. But it is, like we're saying, it's this glaring weakness, and it seems like there's an obvious solution to it, and everybody's just kind of waiting for it to happen.
I think so. Keep in mind, you know, they didn't have Lux at all last year, so you don't necessarily have to assume you're losing. I mean, I think there's potential there. That's what they like about Lux, is he's got pop in his bat, and his left-handed bat is good. He's got good contact skills, but the defense is a big question mark. So, like, you know, I saw one report that said they had, in fact, been shopping him. So I don't know if that's going to amount to anything, but you could maybe conceivably see in a scenario where, you know, they overpay for Adamas, and then they sort of, you know, in prospects maybe, or like MLB ready guys, and then they backfill, they trade Lux for prospects and backfill, you know, something like that.
Yeah, and I mean, this isn't necessarily like, oh, we lost Freddie Freeman for a year to some weird injury, and now his defense is looking weird, and we need to make a spot for him. Like, that's a poor example, but what I'm saying is Lux has a lot of name value. He was a top prospect, like real huge name you couldn't miss, and his first few years didn't go all that well, and his track record to this point, he's got a career 99 WRC plus, and 2022 season, you know, it was his best, and so you could look at it and see like, okay, it took him some time to get settled, but once he did get settled, we saw improvements, and we expected those to continue. And I think that's totally fair and totally defensible. He had a 114 WRC plus in 2022 and was a 3-win player in like 3/4 of a season, basically. So like you're saying, the upside is there. That's what they're playing for there. But also, if he's just going to be a zero defensively for you as a middle infielder, and he's going to hurt you more than he helps you in that regard, this isn't a can't miss bat that you need to force into the lineup necessarily. Like, he has a lot to prove offensively still too, and so that could kind of lend to what you're saying here of where some of these trade rumors come in, or the potential that he sees time coming off the bench as a bench bat instead of a starting middle infielder, where, you know, he's got something to prove. If he proves that he's a 120, 130 WRC plus bat or something, then yeah, you can deal with the bad defense. But he's still not quite proven at that level yet. And so I think there's some fluidity there.
Yep.
Okay. I mentioned him a minute ago. Let's circle back to Zach Wheeler. The Phillies have revamped their infield defense and their outfield defense, and now actually kind of look like an okay, if not maybe slightly above average defensive team. And they re-signed Aaron Nola earlier this offseason, retained him as he hit free agency, and he's a guy who will benefit from that improved defense. And then they managed to get the deal done here with their co-ace as well, Zach Wheeler, who was set to hit free agency following the 2024 season. And it's a record deal here. So it is a shorter term deal, which was kind of expected. There were reports that he wasn't looking to he wasn't looking to be pitching, you know, late into his 30s, early 40s, and get some crazy backloaded deal or anything like that. He kind of knows his limitations. He knows at some point the arm's going to give out, and he doesn't want to be that albatross contract. So instead, it's a 3-year, $126 million extension, which sets the record for highest AAV on any contract extension at $42 million, and fourth highest AAV ever, just behind Ohtani, Scherzer, and Verlander. And, you know, to some people, I bet that was a surprise, but Wheeler is a stud. Like, he has definitely talked his way into that, you know, he's worked his way into that record AAV territory. He's just been kind of quietly awesome for the Phillies since joining that team. You know, just glancing at his ERA column, you know, 2.92, 2.78, 2.82. And then 3.61 last year, but all of the peripherals had him, you know, more in the lower threes. You know, looking at the F4 column, 2020, shortened season, 1.9 wins in 11 starts. That's solid. 2021, 7.2. 2022, 4.2. 2023, 5.9. This is a consistent top-of-the-rotation guy who, in 2021, he made 32 starts and pitched 213 innings. 2022, he missed a handful, but still 26 starts, 153 innings. And then last year, 32 starts, 192 innings. Like, he's as close as we have to A modern workhorse, him and Nola paired at the top, like you feel really good penciling those two in as your 1-2 for the next half decade. And that's what the Phillies get to do with this deal. And by our model, it's maybe just a touch above what we expected. So our model projected a 3-year extension here to be worth 117.6, and he gets 126. So call it a difference of like $3 million a year at that point, which is when you're up in these numbers, can be considered kind of a rounding error. You could also justify it by saying, he was a little bit underpaid perhaps on his current deal, and so maybe this is the Phillies kind of handing some of that back. Or you could view it as, the durability gives him some additional value that might not be fully baked into the numbers. Or you could say he was really pushing for that record extension AAV, and so he was hardlining at that number. There's a few different ways you can look at it, but at the end of the day, it's not worth losing any sleep over a gap that small. It seems like a deal that makes a lot of sense and that both the team and the player should be very happy about.
Yeah, when I was looking at Wheeler's, when I was looking at our model, so we have one of the new features of our site for premium subscribers is, there's an extension tool you can play around with and see like what would this player get in 3 years or 7 years or 10 years or whatever, and the numbers will change each time you toggle back and forth. And so when I was doing that with Wheeler like a couple weeks ago, I was like, wow, he's in the high 30s by our model. Like that seems unusual because he's getting into his, he's older, right? He's getting into his mid-30s. So that seems hard. But then you look at the numbers that you just pointed out, you look at the peripherals, like the underlying metrics, good at baseball savant, there's a whole bunch of red there. You're like, wow, he's got ace material. And to your point, he's been quietly doing that, So I remember when he was first signed by the Phillies, people thought that was an overpay. And it didn't look like it on paper when we looked at it. And so it's proven to be one of the most valuable deals in recent years. Actually, he's been way overperforming that initial contract. Getting $42 million a year as an extension might surprise people, but our model was like, yeah, he's worth 38, 39 a year. So like at first I thought, really? But this validated it. So okay. And the other thing I point out, one of our new writers, James Hirota, included him in an extension article a couple weeks ago. Which was very timely as well. So thinking, okay, this would be a smart one to do, and the most likely one, comparing him to one scenario was extend Wheeler, which seems likely. The other one was the Astros extending Alex Bregman, which seems less likely. So that one seems to have been nailed there. So that's good. And just from a baseball standpoint, I've always been a Wheeler fan. He's just quietly just delivers every time. He's a workhorse, a little bit like Gerrit Cole in that regard, like excellence, excellence. Posts up all the time. So, and then he's the guy you want starting game one in the playoffs, and they did. So, hats off to Dombrowski and the Phillies for giving him what he deserves. The only I gotta say this, the only hesitation I have is he had Tommy John a few years ago, right? And I've been studying this, and I highly recommend the Under the Knife newsletter by Will Carroll, who is an injury expert. One of the points he often makes is there's always kind of a honeymoon period where you have Tommy John and then you're good for a few years, but then it kind of sneaks up on you again. It's typically around year 7. And so I'm watching the clock here on Wheeler. I'm thinking, is it gonna kind of sneak back up again where something goes wrong with his elbow? It's the only nagging sort of thought I have in the back of my mind. And paying him $42 million, you think, well, what if that happens? So otherwise, I love it.
And you can kind of play that one of two ways, right? It's certainly a concern, and it's a concern for any pitcher, especially as they get into their mid to late 30s and continue to post these kind of innings totals and throw as hard as Wheeler does. And like, there's reason for concern there. On the flip side, you can kind of almost look at it as a positive and say that, because he not only had Tommy John surgery, but I believe there were some complications there, so he actually. He made 32 starts in 2014 and then did not pitch in 2015. 2016, he made one start in the minor leagues, and then 2017, he made 17 big league starts. That's that that so basically over that like 3-year period, he made 18 appearances, and one of them was just a one inning minor league rehab appearance.
So he was a mess.
Yes, yeah. You could also view that as kind of a positive though, of say, hey, this guy is 34. but he's got the mileage on his arm of like a 30-year-old from that perspective. Like, yeah, he's probably got half the mileage that a Verlander or a Scherzer did at this age. And obviously that's because of a pretty significant injury and some complications returning from it. But if you want to be optimistic, you can look at it that way and say that that just means he has more bullets to fire.
Okay.
Cool. We'll go ahead and link the aforementioned article from James Hirota. There's some good notes in there on Wheeler as well that hold true after the extension, and good notes on kind of the future of the Phillies rotation, as well as, like you mentioned, the breakdown of Bregman's potential deal and the situation out there in Houston. So highly recommend that. Will be linked in the show notes. Let's pivot over to a much younger pitcher who also got himself an extension, and that's Brian Baio of the Red Sox. This was rumored for a couple weeks, you know, softly rumored by some of the Red Sox beat writers, and came to fruition right ahead of the exhibition spring training game in Baio's native Dominican Republic. So that was cool timing on the Red Sox part and on his camp for that one. And it's a solid deal here. So Baio's is 24, and he really started to establish himself last year, still very, very early in his career, obviously. But he looked like he showed flashes of, you know, possible number two, number three type guy. And at the end of the day, even in a young season that had its ups and downs, he looked like a solid, big league pitcher. You know, he 28 starts of a 4.24 ERA, came out to 1.6 F4. Like, that's comfortable numbers where you can look at the guy and say, yeah, he's gonna stick around. He's got the tools here. He's a big league pitcher, and we feel comfortable with him going forward. And had some underlying numbers that looked a lot better in 2022, and has a strong track record of minor league performance, a strong prospect pedigree, a lot of good signs in Baio's favor, and it makes this deal, you know, if anything, look like a bargain. So it's a 6-year, $55 million extension. I believe there are a pair of club options. Just one club option for $21 million for that sixth season. And so this buys out 1 year of So this buys out 1 year of team control on the original guarantee, and then could be a second, or 1 year of free agency on the original guarantee, and could be a second year of free agency if that club option is exercised. And like I said, it looks like kind of a bit of a bargain here. It's a 6-year, $55 million guarantee, and our model expected 6 years of an extension for Baio to cost $73.8 million. So solid little gap right there. MLB Trade Rumors in their breakdown of this extension notes that Baio signed out of the Dominican Republic for a $28,000 bonus. And so you wonder if maybe that makes a guy a bit more willing to concede a little bit in an early career deal like this and get that money up front, because he hasn't really gotten paid yet at all in his career, and doesn't have that kind of baseline multi-million dollar bonus to be using as kind of leverage in that scenario, I guess. So maybe that contributes a little bit, but at the end of the day, it just seems like a really solid deal for the Red Sox here, locking up one of their more promising young arms here, which they've already made a deal to lock up Garrett Whitlock in a previous offseason, and that one hasn't looked quite as good, but that was also a lower guarantee, and he wasn't quite the prospect Baio was. And so you can see what the plan here is as far as all of these young arms in Boston, and Baio being kind of the one that's to this point risen above the others, and they're going to say, okay, we're going to lock you in before you start getting really expensive, because if you develop the way we expect you to, we would not be able to be anywhere near this territory. We'd be talking, you know, nine figures at least. So that's what this deal is.
Right. So the way also, you know, I was looking at it, and, you know, on a year-by-year breakdown basis, it looks like on paper that the Red Sox would exercise, at least for now, assuming run rates stay, which is never a, you know, thing, but, you know, you gotta model something, right? So they would pick up that seventh year. And so on a seven-year basis, it works out to $76 million that he gets. Our projection over the same 7 years is 84.7, so it's a little bit closer. It's baking in the fact that they would still see some surplus value in that seventh year. So, but still, good deal for Bayo. And the other thing it points out is, you know, the Red Sox have been pretty open about sustainable success, which is the trend du jour, you know, following what the Braves have been doing and locking up all of their young core, and to some extent the Dodgers are doing it. So, like, that's what they want to do. They don't want to continue to overpay. They've been very adamant about that lately, and I know this has been frustrating for Red Sox fans, but Red Sox fans are used to seeing them kind of pay for stars, you know, be a big market team, act like a big market team. And John Henry and the Red Sox ownership is basically saying, no, we want, you know, more of a value sort of approach. And so that means they're not going to overpay for free agents, which is why they still haven't signed Jordan Montgomery. And, you know, it's, again, frustrating the fan base. But this type of thing is what they want to do, kind of invest in the young stars for the future at a lower rate, below market rate, and so that they can lock them up for a while. So that's what Craig Breslow's job is to do, and then he's doing it. You know, I think you have to be careful picking the right, betting on the right horses when you do that, because otherwise it could go bad. We've seen it, you know, the Scott Kingery's and, you know, guys who were signed too early that ended up being busts. So you got to make Evan White of Seattle comes in, or now wherever he ended up, I think he's with the Angels now. But you got to be careful that you know what you're getting, you know, early on. So the sweet spot typically is like, you know, a year into their service time, usually when you still have a lot of leverage as a team, but you kind of know what you have a little bit more at the MLB level. So, and that's a good example of this here.
Yeah, and the Red Sox certainly have another handful of candidates for a deal like this. They have this kind of young wave of talent that has either made it to the big leagues or will be making it to the big leagues in the coming years. And so you look at Sadon Rafaela, who they're very high on but hasn't quite established himself yet. You look at Jarren Duran, who had a really strong season in 2023. I think they probably want to see what he is first, because that was he was kind of tracking as a bust for a couple years there and then bounced back last year. And so I think they might want a little bit more certainty there before they start committing dollars to him. And then coming through the farm, there's a Marcelo Meyer, who's a guy that they're really high on, or a little bit further off, a Miguel Blyce or a Roman Anthony. And then the other obvious name on the offensive side is Tristan Casas. And I bring him up because there was another very good article from one of our contributors this last week, from Jimmy Costello, about some of the younger candidates for extensions and what those might look like. So we looked at kind of the older, nearing free agency superstar types with Bregman and Wheeler. And then Costello also looked at some of the younger stars who are still in those pre-arb years and what that kind of deal might look like. So he looked at Adley Rutschman, Gunnar Henderson, Justin Steele for the Cubs, Royce Lewis for the Twins, who's, you know, as boom or bust as they come, maybe they can give him something similar to the Buxton deal with some of those escalators involved. Tristan Casas for the Red Sox, as I mentioned. And then he also looks at a couple real, real young guys in Yuri Perez and Ellie De La Cruz, who really just made their impact in 2023. So highly recommend that one. It's kind of fun to play GM a little bit with these deals and see what it might cost. And keep in mind that, you know, any extension at this point in a player's career is going to be significantly below like free agent market value. And that's because you have to account for the years of team control that are already, you know, just based off MLB's contract system, they're guaranteed to be underpaid for those years. You know, there's the 3 years at the minimum, and then 3 years of arbitration, which scales, you know, year one, year two, year three, builds on itself. But usually, even by year three of arbitration, you're not quite getting what you're worth if you're one of these superstar types. Like, there's still a gap there. And so that's baked into the deal. So you can't just say, oh, I expect Gunnar Henderson to be worth $40 million in field value in 2024. And that's a number I'm pulling out of nowhere. So that means that a 9-year deal has to be 9 times $40 million for $360 million or something like that. That's not how it works, because he's not making $40 million in 2024. No matter if there's no extension signed, he's making $700K or whatever it is. And so that's some leverage that the teams kind of have on the deal. And they're locking in those years that are already at a below market rate in exchange for potentially, you know, they're guaranteeing those non-guaranteed years in exchange for possibly getting some of those free agent years a little bit below what they might get on the open market. That's the trade-off that happens here. And so that's why with some of these early extensions, you still see surplus value. You know, a guy like Wheeler, he's so close to free agency, he can just hold out for a year and get his fair market value. So you're not going to see much surplus there. But a guy earlier in their career, like Bayo or Bobby Witt that we saw a few weeks back, you're going to see some surplus left on the table. And that's just because of those early years that are guaranteed to have surplus, basically.
Yep. All of that is true. And from the player's perspective, if they're a year into their service time, you know, they're still making league minimum for years two and years three, right? And then they're making below that, you know, with arbitration. And, you know, the typical model is 25% of market value and then 40 and then 60. So to your point, it's nowhere near market value. So that's where they're starting from. Like, can I make a little bit more than that? Can I get paid up front? And oh, by the way, if I get paid up front, you know, maybe I can make that grow by investing it. So over time, you get sort of an edge that way. So it's kind of a win-win given the circumstances that the players are in. And they're nowhere near free agency, so they can't count on that payday for a while. So this kind of accelerates it a little bit and kind of splits the difference. And the team gets the, you know, a good kind of team-friendly deal for many years. And so the other thing I would point out in that article is that we sort of took two sort of precedents. One is what would it be if they went through age 31, which at that point for a lot of stars, they can kind of take a second bite of the apple and say, okay, now I'll get another contract in my 30s. And the other one is for slightly older players or certain types like Adley, who are catchers. I'm sorry, not Adley, but players who are can last through age 37, which is like the full length, and that's a precedent set by Francisco Lindor and Julio Rodriguez and Fernando Tatis. You can kind of like play that out as well. So most of these we played out at age 31, assuming that they would take that second bite. But in case of like Justin Steele, who's already kind of nearing 28 years old, it makes more sense to go through age 37. So you kind of got to get both sides of it and get to play around that way. The other thing I noticed that with Tristan Casas, it's a little bit lighter than you might first thought because he's a first baseman and there's not a lot of defensive value and he's not great at first base anyway. So you're really just betting on the bat there. And he's, you know, still pretty young. So there's probably still some more upside in him. But there's some questions now where, you know, you might, you know, have to consider that, baking that into the deal. None of these are obviously, you know, set in stone. This is just totally like projections and fun to play GM with. But it's, it is fun to kind of see what these would be. And we also sort of, I was just going to say, if you subscribe to the site, you can play around with anybody you want to. This is just a sample size of, you know, some young stars who we played around with and are showing you.
Yeah, definitely. And that'll be linked in the show notes. Mm-hmm. Circling back to the Red Sox for one more quick point here. One quick bit of news is some bad news for them that Lucas Giolito has a partial UCL tear and a flexor strain. Tommy John seems to potentially be on the table. This is not good news for Giolito or for the Red Sox. He was really hoping to reestablish himself in Boston after his atrocious 2023 season. He signed a 1 year $19.5 million deal with a $19 million player option for 2025. And the kind of hope was, you know, he bounces back and then he opts out and hits free agency again. Well, now it's looking like that might just be mostly, if not fully, underwater. If he goes under the knife in April, you're not counting on seeing him until like the All-Star break of 2025, and by that point he will have made, you know, $25-26 million of that contract and pitched zero big league innings. So that's obviously not ideal. The one kind of wrinkle in it that does help the team out is if that player option is exercised, then the team gets a $14 million club option for 2026. So at least, you know, in the best worst case scenario, I guess you could call it, where he does go under the knife and does miss all of this year and half of next year, if he comes back looking okay, then maybe you get this below market rate year at in 2026 at $14 million, and you kind of get a cheap year of hopefully full strength Lucas Giolito, which would be a bargain if he's back to his, you know, peak self that year. But that's obviously far from a certainty. That he comes back and performs well, or that the surgery goes well or anything like that. And at this point, we don't even know for sure if he's having the surgery or not. We just know that things don't look great there. And the kind of common speculation following this was, okay, time to go get Jordan Montgomery, like, yesterday. Like, everybody's been connecting Montgomery to the Red Sox all offseason, and they're holding out because of these, you know, budgetary constraints. But the counterpoint that's been raised on Twitter, and that I think is a really strong argument, is if John Henry and Red Sox ownership did not believe in the team enough to be spending money on Jordan Montgomery before the Giolito injury, why would this change anything there? You know, why would this move the needle for them and say, oh, now we can get Montgomery and that'll lead us to the playoffs? Like, that's not what they're looking at here. So this might be a scenario where Clevinger or Lorenzen is more likely than Montgomery, or maybe it is what tips the needle there, but we'll have to wait and see, especially because it's not even a certainty yet that he is going to be having surgery and missing the full season.
So you could even broaden that point to the larger market and say, well, if you're going for it, you're signing a Blake Snell or maybe a Montgomery. You know, if you're not going for it, why bother? And there are certain teams that are in that latter camp. In addition, they may not want to go for the luxury tax. They may not have the budget in general. They might want to be waiting. You know, the Mets are waiting for 2025 and then and some young talent to come up. Lots of other teams are sort of in that boat. So you wonder, like, you know, I think there's a point there. If you're, you know, you know, I think about the Angels. Like, why would the Angels sign Blake Snell if they're not really a win-now team? You know, because people think, oh, yeah, that's where he's going to go. But they haven't pulled the trigger on that. And it makes me wonder why. It's a similar situation here. If the Red Sox were not a win now team, why spend the money? So, you know, I can't necessarily fault them from a business perspective. They're in a very tough division and doesn't look like they're going to be, you know, better on paper than the Yankees or the Orioles or even the Blue Jays. Or the Rays for that matter. So, you know, it's like, you know, unless you're targeting, maybe you're sort of signing them 1 year early and you're targeting 2025 and beyond, but even then it's hard to see what that future looks like yet. So I kind of get it.
Yeah. And it's kind of this, it's really just indicative of the market as a whole, right? Where the teams that could afford to, and could reasonably be expected to sign one of these guys, they're either really, really good, like the Dodgers could sign Blake Snell, but that's kind of diminishing returns for them on those dollars. They're already so good. He would be replacing a guy who's probably already projected to have like a 2-win season. And so it's just not as significant of an impact. And there's probably a couple other teams that are kind of in that territory as well, where like they're already so good and they'd be bumping out a guy who's already projected to be a valuable big league pitcher. So what's the point there? It's not best value, best bang for your buck. Then the flip side of it is you got these teams like the Giants and the Angels and the Red Sox where, yeah, they're in this like 500-ish territory maybe. And like you're saying, that also doesn't make sense because even adding a 4 or 5 win pitcher to that 500-ish team is just going to put you 4 or 5 games over 500, and that's not guaranteeing a wild card spot even. And so you still need something to go right on top of this large financial commitment and kind of the risk that you're taking on for those back end years of the deal. And then in between are the teams that could truly benefit from a guy like Snell or Montgomery. You know, I'm thinking of the Twins immediately coming to mind there, but they're just tapped out on cash. They're not going to be spending money. They've already decided for whatever reason that this is the budget and this is the team they're rolling into the season with. And so that's kind of the stalemate. It's either waiting for one of those middling teams to change their mind and say, all right, fine, I will spend $20 million, $25 million, $30 million a year on one of these two arms, or waiting for that team on the lower end, you know, the 500-ish teams that have the money to actually, you know, push some chips in and say, you know, maybe if we squint, we can get something going here, and I'm willing to take that chance. So I guess that's the impasse, right?
I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's also a weird time in the market where everybody's kind of at their budget, at their roster. It's hard to see, you know, like suddenly a new, you know, window of opportunity open. Even, you know, Boris, I'm sure, is playing the waiting game in terms of injuries. But even when, like you said, with this scenario in Boston with Giolito, it doesn't really change their mind. With the Giants, yeah, they've had a couple of injuries, and they don't seem to be changing their mind, but they could be being cagey. But there's not a lot of other situations where you're like, yeah, that's, yeah, they're stuck. I think their prices need to come down. I think they just need to get a team. I can't believe Jordan Montgomery is holding out for 7 years, if that's true. I don't know. But at any rate, yeah, you got to take what the market gives you at this point.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's run through some quicker hits here. The White Sox acquired left-handed pitcher Bailey Horn at $2.3 million in surplus from the Cubs in exchange for right-handed pitcher Matthew Thompson at $1.0 million. So, small gap there, but accepted by the model, well within the usual margin of error. And
I have no idea why that trade was made.
It was to make a 40-man spot for Cody Bellinger.
Oh,
the Cubs.
There you go. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Horn was on the 40-man, and so that kind of tracks with the values as well, which we've discussed at length with the Dodgers this offseason, where when you have a 40-man crunch, you're probably not going to get full value for the guy that gets squeezed out, because everybody in the league knows you have a 40-man crunch and you're just trying to get what you can for the guy instead of cutting him for nothing. So that's kind of what the scenario was here, although,
right,
you know, it is a tight gap still. It's just a depth arm for a depth arm, essentially. Okay, and then switching over to a couple smaller free agent deals. The Mariners signed Ryan Stanek to a 1-year $4 million guarantee. They've made a few deals to trade away bullpen pieces this offseason. And they also just found out about injury news for Matt Brash and for recent acquisition Gregory Santos, and Jackson Cowar is also a trade acquisition this offseason. He's having some injury, some arm issues. And so it's a position that we've talked at length about, you know, oh, the Mariners, they can develop all these relievers and they kind of just have a revolving door out there, but it's fine. And now it's starting to look a little bit thin because of some of these injuries and because of some of these trades of guys like Isaiah Campbell and Paul Sewald last year. And I think there's a couple others that I'm missing here. But Stanek is fine. Throws hard, gets outs. He's not going to be your ninth inning guy, but he's also probably not going to let you down. So it's fine. It's inoffensive.
Yeah, Justin Topa is another one they traded away to the Giants,
right,
in the Polanco deal. Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Like, yeah, they got a pitching factory with bullpen arms at least, and well, really both, but they've been you know, turning around, like, you know, guys who were sort of struggling into amazing relievers lately, and then using that as leverage to, you know, to basically trading high when they could, selling off the Justin Toplas and Paul Sewald of the world. But they've got to replenish that, and they've gotten a little too thin, and now it's too close for comfort. So they, yeah, they needed Stanek, and, you know, I'm sure from their point of view, thankfully he was still available. He's serviceable. He's still got some velocity. And $4 million is just a tiny overpay, so that's fine.
Yeah. And on the Mariners, while we're here, Sean Bergeron had a great article for us this last week about just kind of the Mariners' trade history this offseason and what they're left with after all of these shuffling and signing and dumping this contract here and this one there and goodbye Robbie Ray, hello Anthony DeSclafani, and then suddenly goodbye Anthony DeSclafani, hello Jorge Polanco, and where that left them all from both like a surplus standpoint as well as a salary standpoint and field value standpoint. And so very similar to an article he had a few weeks back, kind of looking at the same thing for the Braves wheeling and dealing this offseason. And I think it's just a great way to kind of holistically look at this offseason where, you know, minute by minute, trade by trade, it might not paint the clearest picture, but once you can take a step back, it shows you kind of what the thought process was in the offseason and whether they were successful. So
yeah, and I know there were a lot of grumblings on Twitter from Mariners fans as, you know, Suarez was traded like for basically nothing, and then, you know, they like, what are they doing? And then, you know, they didn't re-sign Teoscar, and so like it felt like they were cutting back, and we talked about that in previous podcasts. They were cutting budget and they were cutting back, and then as the offseason unfolded, okay, now they're getting the reinforcements, now they're getting Polanco and making some smart deals, and so we'll see what Haniger turns out to be in the Robbie Ray trade. But, you know, all of that is means to an end, you know, which shows there was probably a plan. But you know, when I hear executives talk, they often talk about, well, we had a plan A, plan B, and a plan C. Like, you can't just assume plan A is going to go well. So you can't just say, all right, here's what we're going to do. You can't, you know, we're going to trade Eugenio Suarez. We're going to let Teoscar go, and then we're going to get this guy in there. Like, it doesn't always work that way, because it takes two to tango in terms of trades, and they may have other options as well. So all of that is very intricate, and you're banking on all of these things working out. So there's some improvisation that happens on the fly sometimes, where you thought you were going to get this guy, but you didn't, or you thought you were going to make that trade, but you didn't, so you had to pivot to a different one. So it's a lot of maneuvering. And, you know, DePoto, of course, has a reputation for being a trader. So, you know, he's used to maneuvering. So how that all netted out was painted out very well, like I said, I think you said in the article by Sean. So it's fun to read.
Yeah, we'll be linked below. And just to kind of put a bow on all this, while we were recording, it was announced that Jackson Cower will be undergoing Tommy John surgery and missing the year. So unfortunate for him and for the Mariners. And yeah, he's actually going to go to the 60-day injury list to make room on the 40-man for Stanek. So all comes full circle.
Yep.
All right, and then last bit of news here. Finally, Joey Votto has a home. I don't think I've ever seen Twitter celebrate a minor league deal to the extent that most major league deals don't get this level of celebration. Like, everyone was universally stoked about this. Votto signs a minor league deal with the Blue Jays. He's still going to have to kind of fight to crack the roster. Like, he's not been guaranteed a spot by any means, but just glad to see that somebody's giving him a chance. Glad it's the storybook, you know, return to Canada for the future Hall of Famer and just one of the more fun personalities left in baseball. So very happy to see this happen, and I hope he makes it to the big leagues and hits some big home runs for the Blue Jays.
It would make a nice story. I mean, there's a heart versus head thing. Heart, I'm with you. Head, you know, he's what, almost 40, and he had to really, like, I think he's done, you know, so maybe it's just a sentimental play at this point.
Yeah, but I mean, we've all doubted Votto before. We thought 2019 was the beginning of the end, and then suddenly 2021 happens, so he's proven us wrong before. Let's just add this one to the list.
It's true. However, Father Time is undefeated, etc.
Yep. Okay, well, that's about it for news for today. The last thing we really have that we thought would be worth running through very quickly is MLB Trade Rumors, and I'll link to this as well, has published their annual list of players who are out of minor league options. And just wanted to kind of run through here and when a player runs out of options, that obviously gives their team a lot less flexibility with them and kind of sets the bar and says, you need to perform. Otherwise, you're not just, you know, oh, go figure it out in AAA. Like, you're out of here. You're getting DFA'd and any other team can claim you. And as a result of that, what we've noticed, like, historically, a very strong trend that players who are out of options and are kind of on the fringe here, like, we're not talking about, oh no, Mike Trout's out of options or anything, but, you know, these fringier players, and even some of the, you know, some of the players with names that you might recognize a little bit more, once they run out of minor league options, they see that value hit in their trade value, because the acquiring team has that same dilemma where I could trade for you, and if you stink up the bed, then what do I do? Now I've traded something away to get you, and I'm just going to cut you loose and lose you on waivers. Like, that's not ideal. And so because of that, that cuts into the acquisition cost, cuts into the trade value there. So big long list of names here will be linked in the notes. Not going to read this whole list off or anything. I think there's a few names that stand out to each of us. So I will go ahead and pass it to you, John, to start and let me know which of these names are worth noting to you.
Yeah, so the Reds just traded, it was first reported that they traded Jose Barrero, but it then was corrected that he was claimed off of waivers from the Reds. We've had Jose Barrero's trade value down in the dumps for a while now, and he's at zero right now, so to the point that Josh just made, you know, once you get, you know, if you haven't performed, and he hasn't, he's got tools, but he hasn't actually somehow figured it out and put them what those tools he's used. There's always a glimpse like, oh, maybe he's getting it, and then he doesn't. And so it's a lot of sort of tantalizing things like that. Those are the names. Those are the kind of guys that always stand out to me. Franklin Barreto a couple of years ago with the A's, you know, who was the centerpiece of the Josh Donaldson deal, and then just couldn't figure out. They kept giving him chances, but he wasn't quite getting it. Kept swinging it outside sliders, and then, you know, next thing you know, he's out of options, and then he ended up being dumped for basically nothing. Similar story happens a lot. Jose Pereiro is the latest example of that. But I've got my eye on Joe Adele. Joe Adele, I know, has been sort of a popular sort of candidate from Angels fans' point of view to trade, but as his career is in, he still hasn't made it in the MLB level. He still hasn't figured out the strikeout issue, and he now is out of options. So this is it for Joe Adele. I'm watching him in spring training very closely, and he's still striking out. So I got to figure his days are numbered. So that's the first one that comes to mind.
Yeah, scrolling the list, there are a lot of interesting names here where we're going to see rubber hit the road. Is that the
yeah.
analogy?
Yeah.
We're going to see that for guys like Adele. Sticking, you know, the Angels have an interesting crop here. Mickey Moniak showed some flashes last year, but then like really cooled off. And if that was just a mirage, then his days are probably numbered. Luis Renjifo, he's been a pretty valuable like utility guy for them. But if things do turn south there, then they don't have much flexibility. Or Matt Tice, who's had a weird big league career. The A's have a few guys. Kyle Muller was one of the big trade acquisitions by them in the. Oh goodness, that was in the Murphy trade, right? Yeah, Murphy trade. And he was terrible in the big leagues and AAA last year, and so this is really put up or shut up time for him. Luis Medina has shown some flashes with them. He was part of the Frankie Montas package from the Yankees. He's shown some flashes, but he just, I think it was a hamstring injury, so he's going to start the season on the injured list and have to work his way back and force his way onto the roster there. Brewers have an interesting group of guys who are, they just have a weird team, man. So their group here is Jake Bowers, Eric Haas, Joel Piamps, Colin Ray, and Bryce Wilson. And each of those guys have played or are expected to play a big league role for them, but the margin's pretty thin there. If like we've been saying, if any of them show some regression or underperform or whatever, then they're gone.
But those are guys that have bounced around already. Bowers
right.
has bounced around. Haas has bounced around. Colin Ray has bounced, you know, so that you get it. You get that. Like it finally gets a point where like, okay, I can't have you on my roster anymore. And so he gets claimed. So somebody else does the same thing. And they're like, oh, okay, they just keep getting bounced around until the point mm-hmm. where like, we just don't have any room for you anymore. So this is unfortunately the case with a lot of these guys.
Yeah. A couple interesting catchers, Cubs, Miguel Amaya. And Giants mm-hmm. Joey Bart.
Yeah.
Neither of them have really gotten a chance to, well, I take that back. They've gotten their chances, but they have not established themselves as having the skills to stay in the big leagues and have a regular role there. Amaya was okay last season, especially for a catcher, you know, about an average hitting catcher last season. And defensively, he has a decent reputation. And so, you know, that's an easy one for him to stick around as even just a bench guy over there. And even if he's, you know, not the best hitter, he's just a bench catcher. He's your backup catcher that you're not going to lose any sleep over that. But Bart is probably out of time. He's probably done in San Francisco and they're probably going to be looking for a new home for him. I don't think they're going to get much in a trade because, as previously stated, he's out of options and hasn't done a whole lot at the big league level. And so there's not going to be teams that are willing to give up significant talent for that, but somebody might take a flyer as a change of scenery type.
Yep. Estefan Florial was already traded for that
yep.
reason, because he basically ran out of time and ran out of options, and the Guardians were taking a chance at him on him, but, you know, we'll see if he amounts to anything. I think Taylor Trammell's days are numbered in Seattle, since he hasn't done much, and clock, clock has struck midnight there, and that's the thing. So there are other guys on this list that are very well established that aren't going in. Justin Steele's not going anywhere, you know what I mean? It just so happens that from a paperwork standpoint, he's out of options, but that doesn't mean much in that case because he's well established. So you got to look at the guys that are sort of not well established and are sort of right on the fringes of the roster.
Yeah, exactly. The Marlins have a few of those guys. Vidal Brujan, who they just traded for this offseason. Same with Nick Gordon. Edward Cabrera, who should be, you know, he's not firmly in that Justin Steele category yet, but they expect some big league success out of him, but just know that, like, if that doesn't happen, then they're into a tough spot where they probably just tied him in the bullpen and see what happens.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why his value is a little bit lower than you might expect. Mm-hmm. It has been for a while. And Sykes been watching this, and he has been out of options. So, you know, there's not much of a floor there. Because he still has control problems, right? So if he can't cut it as a starter, to your point, they throw him in the bullpen. But what if he can't fix his control problems in the bullpen? So you've still got a dilemma there.
Yeah, and then they also have both Jesus and Sixto Sanchez, former top prospects who have not put it together. Sixto is up to 95 this spring, and maybe there's some room in the bullpen there for him. If not, maybe it's a Brent Honeywell type situation where he scoots around the league and people see if there's anything left in the tank. For the Nationals, Carter Kieboom, I think he's been kind of done for a while.
Yeah.
But this is potentially the end of the road there. The Orioles, I want to mention Jorge Mateo and Nick Maton. Not that either of them are... Oh, and Ramon Urias while we're here. Not that any of them are massive names, but the Orioles have this flux of young infielders. You know, they already have Gunnar at the big league level, and Jackson Holliday is doing everything he can to break camp with the team, and he would be their second baseman. Jordan Westberg at third base. Kobe Mayo is also knocking on the door, top third base prospect. They got Connor Norby as an infield prospect. First base is pretty settled with Ryan Mountcastle and Ryan O'Hearn. And so very crowded infield picture, and that's before you get into these veterans who have produced for them in the past. And, you know, you're not getting a haul in a trade for Jorge Mateo or Ramon Urias, but it seems like one of those two guys might get forced off this roster, especially if you are making room for Jackson Holliday on opening day. So that's a situation to watch, especially for some of these teams that might need an infielder. You know, does one of them land with the Dodgers? I don't know if either of them plays a good enough shortstop for that, but along those lines.
Exactly. So you get the sense that kind of the old guard is kind of on its way out. The guys who were placeholders, you know, while the young guys were still developing, now the young guys are coming in and make room for Jackson Holliday and, you know, Jordan Westberg and the other guys. So, like, you know, there's four infielders here on this Orioles list: Mateo, Maton, Tyler Nevin, and Urias. And so I see at least two of them getting moved some way.
Agreed. Handful more here. The Phillies, Christian Pache, he's been out of options for a couple years now, I believe. And Jake Cave as well. And so they have kind of an outfield battle going with those guys and Johan Rojas. And so it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. Dylan Covey there as well. I think they liked what he was able to do as like a length option for them. And they don't have a ton of starting pitching depth beyond their top five guys. So I wonder if he makes the bullpen as a swingman just to keep him in the organization and kind of stretched out in case they need him. The Pirates, Ronzi Contreras had some prospect hype and has kind of quieted it down since then, and so this is a real make or break year for him. Scrolling through this list, the Rays reportedly were trying to trade Harold Ramirez throughout the offseason and never really found a taker. That, you know, he's a valuable player on a roster, but probably not a full-time guy, more of a platoon bat, and starting to make a little bit of money here, so maybe that is a trade that could happen later in spring or early in the season as injuries occur across the league, things like that.
I mean, he's a one-trick pony, right? He hits the lefties, no defense. He's a DH, not used against righties, and starting to make some money. So, and now out of options. So, like, the writing's on the wall there.
Absolutely. Red Sox, I think, might have mentioned this on a previous episode, but Brian Mehta, who was one of their top pitching prospects, some underperformance and injuries have kind of bumped him down that list, and he was hoping to make the bullpen out of spring training here and avoid this issue, but then he suffered an injury of his own, and so then that's in question. The Twins have a few relievers here, Jay Jackson, Steven Okert, and Brock Stewart, which are just names to monitor. You know, they liked what they saw in kind of a short stint from Stewart last year. They just traded for Okert and just signed Jay Jackson. But if any of those guys go south, then they are probably right back out the door. And I think that's kind of those are the names that stand out to me from this list. There's a handful of others in here. Like I said, this will be linked. A lot of them are just those types that you'd expect. You know, nobody's going to lose sleep over Stuart Fairchild with the Reds or Pablo Reyes with the Red Sox. But there's some interesting names in here. And it does play a meaningful role in roster decisions as well as, you know, trade value and trade considerations. So it's definitely something to be aware of and something that we are tracking very closely every year.
Yeah, just one more name real quick. Ben Rortvedt of the Yankees is kind of like their third or fourth catcher at this point. He's out of options, so I can see him getting moved because they've got Austin Wells, they've got Jose Trevino, so I, you know, hard to see him getting much playing time. But there's a larger point I want to make here, too, is that we see this coming. We've been doing this for a while now. We notice that if you're out of options, you get traded or, you know, or very likely to. And so then we sort of like step back and say, okay, what if you have one left? And so then that hurts your trade value a little bit too, because the clock, GMs know that the clock is ticking on that one. Like, this is your, like, almost last year, right? So, like, we need you to start performing or else. And then next year, it's really going to be time to make or break. So there's already sort of a ramp there with a guy who's already burning, you know, burned two options down to one left. So we sort of look at that. But then also, there are guys who get added to the 40-man roster a little early by necessity. And these tend to be, international signings, because that sort of signing period, they tend to be younger, right? So they're signed when they're 16 sometimes, and then they've got a few years to kind of get development. But then by the time they need to be added to the 40 or protected from the Rule 5 roster, they might be in like still high A as 21-year-olds. And so then you think, okay, they're talented, so we add them to the roster. Then we start burning options in double A, high A and double A, triple A, and then next thing you know, they're 23, 24, and they're out of options. And that's what happened with Luis Medina, which is why he was traded as I think it was part of the Frankie Montas deal. And, you know, so the Yankees tend to have a lot of these types of guys. So they get added to the 42 early in effect, and they have to burn through options as a result. So we keep an eye on those things as well, because that effectively means by the time they make it to the big leagues, they may be at zero or one in terms of options. So they really, it really does put the pressure on them.
Yeah. And if you're like we said, if you're good enough, then that fades away. If you hit the ground running, even if you're out and you're looking like a young budding superstar and you put two solid years of performance behind you, then nobody really cares that you're out of options. They trust that you're a young superstar and you're going to stay on the roster anyway. Mm-hmm. But for some of these fringe guys and even kind of the next tier above fringe guys, it really is a consideration.
Yep.
Well, cool. That's all I have for today. Is there anything we missed here, John?
No, you know, again, I'll bookend this with, is the off season over or not? So we're going to start treating it like it is, because we got to move on. So if, you know, Snell or Montgomery or whoever, JD Martinez is still out there, a few other guys, if they start to sign, so be it. But we got to, at some point, we got to call it. So, and get our off season recaps out there, which we'll start working on.
Agreed. Yeah, there's still going to be plenty of moves, I assume. You know, whether it's these out of options guys, whether it's the free agents, whether it's the last handful of trade candidates that are sticking where they are. And I have a feeling we're going to see a lot of rosters shift even as the season starts here. You know, technically the season starts next week with that Korea series. Mm-hmm. And I don't think all of this is going to get shaken out before then. So we might see this bleed into the season. But like you said, we got to call it at some point.
Yep.
Well, as far as this episode goes, we'll be calling it right now. That'll do it for this week. Thank you all so much for listening. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to shoot us an email at baseballtradevalues@gmail.com or find us on Twitter at baseballvalues. Also, be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. We'll be back in a couple weeks to break down more news and updates. So until then, stay safe and enjoy a couple weeks of spring training and a couple big league regular season games. Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.